From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Tampa, Florida.
Today I'd like to speak directly to the people across the broader Middle East. My country desires peace.
No, I'm near that at all.
Insecurity in Iraq affects the entire region. Can the Security Council play a role in restoring peace and security in Iraq while the occupiers are themselves permanent members of the Council?
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and President Bush clash in separate speeches before the UN General Assembly. Then military leaders in Thailand stage a bloodless coup and declare martial law, all while the Thai Prime Minister is in New York at the UN. We'll go to Bangkok to get the latest. Then the FCC buries two studies critical of media consolidation. And we'll talk to Maher Arar, the Syrian-born Canadian citizen who was sent by U.S. authorities to Syria through the CIA's secret extraordinary rendition program. He was held for a year in a jail and tortured. He'll respond to the official Canadian report that vindicates him and criticizes the U.S. government for what it did to him. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. Speaking from the same lectern within hours of each other, President Bush and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad traded criticism Tuesday at the opening session of the UN General Assembly. Taking the podium first, President Bush threatened consequences if Iran does not return to international talks on its nuclear program. Iran has said it's open to the talks but won't accept the administration's precondition for a freeze on nuclear activities. In an appeal to Iranian citizens, Bush said Iran's leaders were misrepresenting U.S. intentions and using state funds to sponsor terror and build nuclear weapons. The president also defended his so-called freedom agenda in the Middle East.
Today, I'd like to speak directly to the people across the broader Middle East. My country desires peace. Extremists in your midst spread propaganda claiming that the West is engaged in a war against Islam. This propaganda is false, and its purpose is to confuse you and justify acts of terror. We respect Islam, but we will protect our people from those who pervert Islam to sow death and destruction.
Hours later, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad defended his country's nuclear program, which he said is for peaceful purposes. Ahmadinejad accused the U.S. and Britain of using the U.N. Security Council to advance their own agendas and said the occupation of Iraq is fueling instability.
It seems that intensification of hostilities and terrorism serves as a pretext for the continued presence of foreign forces in Iraq. Where can the people of Iraq seek refuge, and from whom should the government of Iraq seek justice? Who can ensure Iraq's security? Insecurity in Iraq affects the entire region. Can the Security Council play a role in restoring peace and security in Iraq while the occupiers are themselves permanent members of the Council?
Outside the General Assembly, thousands of protesters rallied against the ongoing war in Iraq and called for an end to all wars. 17 activists were arrested for civil disobedience after they tried to deliver President Bush an indictment charging him with crimes against humanity.
I'm protesting the war in Iraq, the potential of war in Iran, which I certainly don't want, the need for peace, the need for dialogue, and not to resort to war as a way of solving problems.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan also spoke Tuesday in what was billed as his final address to world leaders before he steps down at the end of the year. Annan spoke about the need to end the crisis in Darfur.
Sadly, once again, the biggest challenge comes from Africa, from Darfur, where the continued spectacle of men and women and children driven from their homes by murder, rape, and burning of their villages makes a mockery of our claim as an international community to shield people from the worst abuses.
Darfur is among the top issues at this week's summit. During his speech, President Bush announced the appointment of a new special envoy to deal with the crisis. Andrew Natsios, a former director of the State Department's aid agency, USAID. The appointment's already drawing controversy over past statements Natsios has made about Africa. In a June 2001 interview with the Boston Globe, Natsios suggested global AIDS funding should be devoted almost entirely to prevention instead of treating those suffering from the disease. Natsios said paying for antiretroviral treatment is impractical because, quote, Africans don't know what Western time is. He added, quote, you have to take AIDS drugs a certain number of hours a day or they don't work. Many people in Africa have never seen a clock or a watch in their entire lives. A new crisis is developing in Thailand, where military leaders have staged a bloodless coup. On Tuesday, tanks rolled into the capital, Bangkok. Soldiers seized government offices and took up strategic positions around the city. In a broadcast aired across the country, coup leaders declared nationwide martial law and ordered all troops to return to their bases. A spokesperson said the seizure would be temporary and power returned to the people soon. Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra was in New York for the UN General Assembly. It's unclear whether he intends to return home. The coup follows months of growing tension in Thailand. Numerous protests have called for the prime minister's ouster. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We will have more on the situation in Thailand later in the broadcast. In Iraq, at least 64 people were killed Tuesday in violence around the country. The dead include four U.S. troops. The deaths come amid new figures showing the number of U.S. troops wounded. The number has now passed 20,000. The top American military commander in the Middle East is now warning the Pentagon will maintain and may even increase the number of U.S. troops. General John Abizaid says he expects at least 140,000 troops to stay in Iraq through the spring. There are currently 147,000 troops in Iraq, up 20,000 since June. Meanwhile, there have been major developments in the ongoing trial of Saddam Hussein. In a move decried by international legal observers, the Iraqi government removed the presiding judge over comments he made in the courtroom. In an exchange with Saddam Hussein last week, the judge said the former Iraqi leader was not a dictator during his years of rule. Richard Dicker, a legal observer for Human Rights Watch, said, quote, the transfer effectively sends a chilling message to all judges, toe the line or risk removal. In court today, the new judge in the trial removed Hussein from the court after Hussein refused to end a defiant speech accusing the judge of being a U.S. spy. In other Iraq news, a British soldier has become the first to admit to committing a war crime. The soldier, Corporal Donald Payne, pleaded guilty Tuesday to the inhumane treatment of Iraqi civilians. Six other soldiers are charged in the death of an Iraqi man seized by British forces in Basra 3 years ago. They've all pleaded not guilty. The UN has issued a new warning over the more than 250,000 unexploded cluster bombs littered across southern Lebanon. David Shearer, the UN humanitarian coordinator in Lebanon, says unexploded bombs are killing an average three people every day. And that figure could rise, Shearer says. There could be up to 350,000 unexploded cluster bombs still on the ground. And it'll take at least a year for most to be cleared. Here in the United States, a leading Muslim advocacy group says reported anti-Muslim incidents are up 30%. According to the Council on American Islamic Relations, that's the highest number of incidents since the group began keeping track 11 years ago. New figures released by the FBI this week show marijuana arrests are now at an all-time high. More than 780,000 people were arrested last year for marijuana violations. That's over 40% of all drug arrests in the United States. Almost 9 in 10 were arrested for possession. Alan St. Pierre of Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, said, quote, arresting hundreds of thousands of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly needlessly destroys the lives of otherwise law-abiding citizens. It makes no sense to continue to treat nearly half of all Americans as criminals for their use of a substance that poses no greater health risks than alcohol or tobacco, he said. Growing corruption on Capitol Hill is leading to an increased workload at the FBI. The New York Daily News reports the FBI has tripled the number of squads investigating lobbyists and lawmakers in the nation's capital. An FBI official says the agency would like even more agents to work on the growing number of cases. In health news, a new internal review says the Environmental Protection Agency has not been conducting mandatory environmental assessments of low-income and minority neighborhoods. The environmental justice assessments were mandated in 1994 to ensure those neighborhoods are getting the same environmental protections as other neighborhoods. The EPA's Inspector General says nearly two-thirds of regional offices have failed to carry out the assessments. The findings were released by Democratic Senator John Kerry. Kerry says the results show the Bush administration, quote, couldn't care less about low-income and minority neighborhoods. The Federal Communications Commission has ordered an investigation into why two reports that called into question media consolidation were never released to the public. Both reports have come to light in just the last week. A former FCC lawyer says top agency officials ordered staff to destroy every last copy of one of the studies. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. And more developments in the Hewlett-Packard spy case. Newly disclosed documents show executives investigating the source of boardroom news leaks looked into the feasibility of planting spies at two major publications. New York Times reports HP officials strongly considered a plan that would have placed investigations acting as clerical or maintenance staffers at the offices of the Wall Street Journal and the website CNET.com. It's not clear whether the plan was implemented. And finally, the Bush administration is being accused of trying to stop a government scientist from discussing the link between global warming and hurricanes. The scientist, Tom Knutson, had projected a small increase in hurricane activity because of greenhouse gases. Newly released emails show government officials blocked an interview request from the cable news network CNBC after learning of Knutson's position. Referring to scientists who'd publicly doubted links with global warming, Commerce Department Press Secretary Chuck Fuqua replied, quote, why can't we have one of the other guys? And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. The 61st Annual United Nations General Assembly has opened in New York. This year's agenda for the 192 UN member states includes trying to promote Mideast peace, curb Iran's nuclear ambitions, get UN peacekeepers into conflict-racked Darfur, and promote democracy. Over a week and a half, each nation is allotted 15 minutes at the General Assembly's dais to deliver a speech about the issues most important to them. President Bush spoke yesterday morning. In a speech, he pressed Iran to return to international talks on its nuclear program and threaten consequences if they don't.
The United Nations has passed a clear resolution requiring that the regime in Tehran meet its international obligations. Iran must abandon its nuclear weapons ambitions. Despite what the regime tells you, we have no objection to Iran's pursuit of a truly peaceful nuclear power program. We're working toward a diplomatic solution to this crisis. And as we do, we look to the day when you can live in freedom, and America and Iran can be good friends and close partners in the cause of peace.
President Bush also applauded the new government in Iraq and promised to defend Afghanistan from a resurgent Taliban. Hours later, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad addressed the General Assembly. He defended his country's nuclear program, saying it was for peaceful purposes. He also accused the United States and Britain of using the UN Security Council to advance their own agendas.
Ali Janaban.
Excellencies. The question needs to be asked, if the governments of the United States or the United Kingdom, who are permanent members of the Security Council, commit aggression, occupation, and violation of international law, which of the organs of the UN can take them to account? Can a council in which they are privileged members address their violations?
می تواند به جرم آنان رسیدگی کند
Has this ever happened?
Outside of the United Nations, thousands of protesters gathered to call for an end to the ongoing war in Iraq and an end to all wars. As President Bush stepped to the podium, a group of 17 activists were arrested for civil disobedience as they called for the ouster of President Bush for crimes against humanity. One of those arrested was Anne Wright. She's one of three State Department officials to publicly resign in protest of the Iraq War in 2003. Here she's speaking at yesterday's protest.
Well, we're here to protest George Bush being at the United Nations again to tell the lies of this administration. And as he did 3 years ago before the attack on Iraq, we fear that this time he's telling the same lies about Iran. And we're here to protest the lies he's told for the last 3 years about Iraq, the torture, the rendition, all of the things that have happened about Iraq, including eavesdropping.
Phyllis Bennis now joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C., a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She specializes in the Middle East and United Nations. She's the author of a number of books, including Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.N. Defy U.S. Policy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what President Ahmadinejad and President Bush, the major conflict going on, expressed on the world stage at the UN?
Well, it was very interesting to watch yesterday, Amy. In President Bush's speech, which interestingly was bookended by the Brazilian President Lula and South African President Mbeki, who both used their time at the UN podium for very different purposes, President Bush stood out with trying to frame what he is calling a new ideological divide in the world. It's no longer a world, he's telling us, between communism and capitalism. It's no longer even the axis of evil. His new language is the world divided between moderates and extremists. And he talked a lot about democracy, although not in the same language that he has in the past, and called on the world to support the moderates. The problem is, of course, he was also talking about how people must respect elected leaders, and he keeps coming up against the fact that those who are elected in the Middle East, whenever elections are held at all, tend to be not the people that he considers moderates. So there was this very interesting sort of reframing of his so-called global war on terrorism to be framed as a war for moderation against extremism. What was interesting, I thought, in terms of his references to Iran, he made a fairly generalized, threatening in tone statement, Iran must abide by the Security Council resolutions, but he stopped right there. He did not go on to talk about any particular moves that the U.S. would take. He didn't threaten greater economic sanctions coming from the Security Council because it's becoming clearer and clearer that he is not going to be able to win a serious sanctions motion. French President Jacques Chirac yesterday took the opportunity to distance himself from the Bush administration, essentially saying that the most important thing is to get back to negotiations with Iran, and that that Chirac was perfectly prepared to go ahead with negotiations even before any sort of suspension of uranium enrichment on the part of Iran, something very different from the U.S. side. Ahmadinejad's presentation was far less about the particulars of the conflict between Iran and the U.S. on the question of nuclear power, but rather on the question of U.S. control and domination of the Security Council and the undemocratic nature of the United Nations, a longstanding challenge at the UN. What this may refer to, I'm afraid, is that the U.S. may be in the process of giving up a focus on the United Nations as the key venue for working out their escalating attacks on Iran if they feel that they are simply not going to get the support they want, do what they did regarding Iraq, which was to deem the Security Council and the UN as a whole in general to be what they called irrelevant, and go ahead on a unilateral basis. That would be reflected in the new stories that have come out in the last couple of days in Time magazine and elsewhere, indicating that there have, in fact, been orders preparing to deploy U.S. Navy warships towards Iran, with the goal being not necessarily a direct military strike, but rather a naval blockade of Iranian oil ports, which, of course, constitute an act of war. In that situation, the danger, of course, is that if there was, for example, imagine a week or so of a U.S. blockade of Iran's ports, Iran knows, its government and its people know, that that's an act of war. Most Americans don't know that a blockade is considered an act of war. And if Iran responded militarily, which unfortunately would be their right under Article 51 of the UN Charter calling for self-defense rights, the Bush administration would very likely call that an unprovoked attack on peaceful U.S. ships and would respond militarily, claiming to be responding in self-defense. That's, I think, a very serious danger that we face right now. And seeing Bush at the United Nations choosing not to use that rostrum as a podium for escalating threats, direct threats against Iran, it makes the danger of a unilateral military move right now all the greater.
Phyllis Bennis, Kofi Annan also giving his last major address to world leaders after 10 years at the United Nations in December, pleaded for Security Council action to end the Arab-Israeli conflict, saying efforts to solve all other Middle East crises would face resistance while the Palestinian question remains unresolved.
He did say that, and that was a very important move. It was interesting also, Amy, that Brazilian President Lula echoed the words of Kofi Annan. He spoke right after the Secretary General, and he called directly. He said, quote, "Is it not time to call a UN-sponsored conference in the region with the participation of all countries in the region?" A very important proposal. I think it was also important that the Secretary General, beyond his focus on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the need to end occupation, and he spoke of the 40 years of occupation in very direct language, he also was uncharacteristically direct in referring to what was unmistakably, although he didn't name the U.S., it was unmistakably U.S. hypocrisy regarding issues of torture, extraordinary rendition, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, etc., when he said, and the quote here from Kofi Annan, "Even the necessary and legitimate struggle around the world against terrorism is used as a pretext to abridge or abrogate fundamental human rights, thereby ceding moral ground to the terrorists and helping them find new recruits." That was quite unusual for this usually very, very cautious Secretary General, and I think the fact that it was his last chance to address the General Assembly made it possible for him to come out more direct. President Bush, of course, in his speech, when he spoke about both Lebanon and Israel-Palestine very narrowly. He actually said at one point, "From Beirut to Baghdad, people are making the choice for freedom," an extraordinarily terrible choice of words, given that it's in the aftermath of the war in Beirut as well as currently in Baghdad, that people are barely surviving the level of violence and whatever else is going on there. This is not the choice that people have made. Regarding Palestine, Bush spoke of being committed, quote, to a Palestinian state that has territorial integrity. Now, that's a very dangerous frame. He went on to say, and that would live peacefully with the Jewish state of Israel. All of this coded language for saying that he will not require Israel to give up the huge swaths of territory in the West Bank that it is planning to annex, something that Bush had agreed to back in April of 2004 with then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. But he is also apparently accepting Sharon's concept of what Sharon called transportation contiguity for a state, meaning the state doesn't actually have to be contiguous if you can drive from one part to another, even if you have to go underground in a tunnel, over the ground in a bridge, into a hot air balloon, for that matter. Territorial integrity is a whole new concept that Bush is now floating, perhaps as a trial balloon. He also spoke specifically about the Jewish state of Israel, which is, again, a code word for opposing the Palestinian right of return, which Bush has said, in April 2004, in letters exchanged with Prime Minister Sharon, that he would not accept. So this was essentially a restatement of the Bush administration's endorsement of the Israeli plans for massive land annexation, rejection of the internationally legally required Palestinian right of return as the basis for what the U.S. will call a commitment to a Palestinian state.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for joining us. Phyllis Bennis is author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the U.S. and the U.N. Defy U.S. Power. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the bloodless coup in Thailand. Stay with us.
What am I so hyped for? A fire light, you know. Oh, you better off. Show love, cause there is hope, yeah. Hey, do not fight. No, you can work it out, yeah. We don't need no war. Many lives go to waste, and all those loved ones, no one can take their place. I say you better off. Show love, cause there is hope. Doesn't know how to live, much less how they survive. Some vindictive feelings, some dirty vibes, causing you to be moving like the scribes. You got a personal thing within yourself. That's what you do. You kill others and see yourself. You do two words.
Don't Need War by Sisla here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. Military leaders in Thailand staged a bloodless coup Tuesday night and suspended the Constitution, declared martial law. Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra was in New York for the UN General Assembly. He canceled his scheduled speech last night. It's unclear whether he intends to return home. The leader of the coup, General Santhi Buniyarakin, told a news conference today that a new prime minister will be named within 2 weeks. He said new elections would take place in a year's time once a new constitution has been written. He also warned the ousted prime minister could face charges. The Thai armed forces seized power without firing a shot. Tanks rolled into the capital of Bangkok as soldiers seized government offices and took up strategic positions around the city. In a broadcast on all Thai television channels, the leadership of the armed forces said it had taken control, declared nationwide martial law, and ordered all troops to return to their bases. A spokesman for the coup leaders said the seizure would be temporary and power would be returned to the people soon.
It is clear that the administration of the interim government has created a conflict that is spreading among Thai people. This has never happened before, and each of the factions is trying to overtake one another. And it is deteriorating without any sign of getting better. The people are starting to doubt the government due to corruption and abuse of power. The independent agencies have been dominated by politicians, and this creates a chaotic political atmosphere. And there have been many times when the monarch was nearly insulted.
The heads of the armed forces went to the palace to visit the highly revered king and declared loyalty to him. The Thai king has made no comment about whether he backs the takeover. The military said the country's stock market, banks, and schools would remain closed on Wednesday. BBC World, CNN, and other international TV news channels have been taken off the air, while Thai stations have broadcast footage of the royal family and patriotic songs. Reuters is reporting the Thai army has banned gatherings of more than five people. The coup followed months of growing tension in Thailand with protests against the prime minister in a general election, which was annulled due to concerns about its legitimacy. Chinita Chanyapate Bamford joins us on the line from Bangkok. She's deputy director of Focus on the Global South. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe what has happened in Thailand?
It's been quiet, and basically, as you said, there has been no bloodshed so far. But we feel the situation is still volatile because obviously the split this. I have to try to make sure that there would be no opposition or no resistance. Today, you know, we have seen some comments from the city because they have declared a holiday. So there is no further news except for the occasional statement, short statement put out by the coup leaders.
Your attitude toward the prime minister who was just deposed?
Pardon?
What is your assessment of the prime minister who was just deposed?
The prime minister who was just deposed, we have heard no news from him except that he's probably deciding whether to come back into Thailand, to risk coming back to Thailand, or to do something else. But basically, all the cabinet ministers have left Thailand, and all the prime minister's family as well.
And as a grassroots activist in Thailand, can you talk about the military coup? Who are the forces that have deposed the prime minister?
The coup leaders is the army chief, and then he's got the support of, as he claims, all the supreme commander of the armed forces and the chief of the police. So that's all we know so far about five or six people who have shown themselves. So this was really a surprise because we, of course, have thought that the days of the coup d'etat have been over. And so I think the Thais are still trying to think of what should be our reaction to this type of situation. So there must be a lot of conferences behind closed doors today, but there's not many people in the streets. So we probably have to take a wait-and-see position.
And the attitude of the people toward the prime minister, what is he being accused of?
He's being accused physically and the same way as described by the coup d'etat, abuse of power, arrogance, and what they call policy corruption. So it's not really, you know, criminal offense or actual corruptions, but in terms of that kind of making unethical deals or shady deals that prompted people to question the transparency and the legitimacy of his rule, his government. And that has been, of course, this has been the sentiment of quite a large majority of the people that prompted them to boycott the April 2 election, to vote no vote in that election. And 9 million people voted no vote in that election. So that was how people expressed their question against the Thaksin government. So the situation has become has remained volatile because Mr. Thaksin himself definitely did not accept that those charges and would not budge really from his position as the head of the biggest Thairak Thai party. And a lot of there were questions about his intention in the new election, whether he would resume premiership. And he kept evading that, he evaded questions all the time. So that was the uncertainty that was building up because the People's Alliance for Democracy is taking up this issue again because they basically think that as a responsible leader, he has to face these charges. Or actually, if he doesn't want to explain anything, he should resign.
Chinita Chanyapate Bamford, we're going to have to leave it there because we're having a hard time hearing you. I want to thank you very much for joining us from Bangkok. As we turn back to the United States, for the second week in a row, the Federal Communications Commission is facing allegations of censorship. Yesterday, it was disclosed the agency buried a critical study of media consolidation. The study, titled A Review of the Radio Industry, found the Telecommunications Act of 1996 had led to a drastic decline in the number of radio stations owners, even as the actual number of commercial stations in the United States had increased. Well, last week, a former FCC lawyer revealed top officials ordered staff to destroy all copies of a draft of another study, which concluded that greater concentration of media ownership hurt local TV news coverage. Both former FCC Chair Michael Powell and current Chair Kevin Martin deny ever seeing the reports. Yesterday, Martin ordered a formal investigation into why these two agency reports were never made public. Tim Carr joins us now from New York. He is a campaign coordinator with the organization Free Press. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Can you explain each of these reports, what has happened? The first report, then the second.
Well, the first report, which came to light during Chairman Kevin Martin's confirmation hearings last week, actually dealt with the content of news in locally owned stations. It showed that locally owned stations, on average, did 5.5 minutes more per half hour of local news than their consolidated counterparts. Now, this report, which challenged a lot of the assertions of then-Chairman Powell that consolidated stations were much more likely to cover local news, disappeared. We don't know where it is. We didn't know where it went in 2004. We know today that it was buried. The second report, which came to light later in the week, it actually came to light over the weekend and was revealed on Monday morning, also looked, as you said, at radio ownership and showed that while commercial stations increased in number, the actual ownership decreased by 35%. And in most cases, you had very large corporations like Clear Channel buying up more and more of these local stations. So we've been very concerned. Free Press is part of a coalition called StopBigMedia.com, various groups that have called on Chairman Martin to launch a thorough investigation of these disappearing reports. And thankfully, yesterday, Chairman Martin did just that. So we are hoping that this independent investigation will reveal the extent to which this information has been buried at these federal agencies. And we're also asking that in the current review of media ownership, that no decision be made at the FCC until this full report is revealed. And we know whether or not there has been any meddling at the FCC to bury evidence that, in fact, shows that big media is bad for us American people.
Now, presumably, a number of people had to be involved with these reports. How was the squelching of not one but two reports carried out and only being exposed now?
Well, we're thankful that there were whistleblowers within the FCC who have alerted us that these reports existed. Otherwise, they would be gathering dust somewhere at the FCC. And so the process is unclear. Both Chairman Martin and former Chairman Powell have said that they knew nothing about the reports, and they've denied repeatedly, which is a little bit absurd. I mean, it seems to me that they're more interested in protecting their political legacy than they are in actually getting to the truth of the matter. Fortunately, we do have this investigation. We hope that it will be thorough. We hope that it will reveal exactly how these reports were buried.
Now the public comment period on media consolidation has been expanded. Is that right?
That's right. We have a month more. As you may know the history, in 2003, then-Chairman Powell tried to rewrite media ownership rules that really loosened the last significant holds to media consolidation. There was a massive public outcry. It was rebuked by Congress, and the Third District Court in Philadelphia then threw it back to the FCC. The FCC is now rewriting those rules, and over the summer, Chairman Martin issued what's called a notice of public rulemaking, and he has asked the public to comment on this process. So in 2003, when the public commented on this process, more than 97% of those commenting were against media consolidation. So now we have 3 months. We have until the end of December to get our comments in, and we're helping people at StopBigMedia.com do that. Free Press is helping out as well with a number of other organizations so that the chairman can make a decision on whether or not to loosen further ownership curbs with full public consent. And we expect that this time around he will listen to the public opinion and make a decision accordingly.
And a hearing will be held in Los Angeles soon?
That's right. We have the Chairman Martin, when he did release this notice of public rulemaking, committed to holding at least a half dozen public hearings, the first of which is scheduled for October 3rd in Los Angeles. In the interim, a number of other groups have been convening public hearings with FCC commissioners, Commissioners Adelstein, Commissioner Copps. They have both come to several in the past. Here in New York on October 19th, the National Hispanic Media Coalition is planning to do an FCC hearing. They've invited all the commissioners to come. So this is a very important process, and it's important that everybody turn out to these meetings. There's a chance for the public to testify, goes right into the public record before the commissioners, and tell them how media consolidation impacts them in their communities. So this
Tim Carr, I want to thank you very much for being with us, campaign director for the organization Free Press, Media Reform Group. This is Democracy Now. When we come back from break, we head to Canada. We'll speak with Maher Arar. A new report has just come out vindicating him and criticizing the U.S. government, who sent him to Syria, where he was tortured. Stay with us.
Quote, love, unquote, me. Well, stranger things have come to be, but let's agree to disagree, 'cause I don't believe you. I don't.
Believe you, the magnetic fields here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has refused to apologize to Maher Arar despite Arar's exoneration by a federal inquiry. 4 years ago, Maher Arar was on his way back to Canada from a family vacation in Tunisia. The Syrian-born Canadian citizen had a stopover at JFK Airport in New York. After being questioned at the airport, U.S. officials took him to a New York immigration facility. 2 weeks later, he was secretly flown to Jordan aboard a Gulfstream jet. Maher Arar ended up in Syria, where he was held in a cell the size of a grave. He was physically and psychologically tortured, forced to confess to having trained in Afghanistan, where he's never been. He was released after a year, never charged with a crime. On Monday, the Canadian government admitted for the first time Maher Arar is a completely innocent man. Justice Dennis O'Connor, who led the inquiry, said the U.S. government's decision to send Arar to Syria was likely based on inaccurate and misleading information provided by Canadian authorities. On Tuesday, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper acknowledged a tremendous injustice had taken place, but declined to apologize. Maher Arar joins us now on the phone from Canada. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maher Arar.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you talk about your response to the inquiry?
I'm extremely delighted that the inquiry cleared my name. I do believe that the public have always believed in my innocence, but this is the first time a respected jurist cleared my name, in hopefully in a way that will allow me to rebuild my life.
What surprised you most by the findings of this inquiry?
Well, a couple of things, but from the personal point of view, I was extremely shocked to learn that my wife and I, and also my kids, were placed on a watch list, both in Canada and in the States, and we were both described, my wife and I, as Islamic extremists. And that was really the most shocking news that I learned. Of course, there are other things that we learned, but from a personal point of view, that was really the most shocking thing. For my kids to be placed on a watch list, just to remind everyone, my son at the time was 6 months old, and my daughter was 6 years old. And the answer that I have right now is how many other innocent people and innocent kids and babies are placed on this kind of list.
I wanted to get your response to what the U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said. He said Mr. Arar was deported under immigration laws. He was initially detained because his name appeared on terrorist lists. He was deported according to our laws. Gonzalez said that your removal was a deportation, not a rendition. Quote, even if it were a rendition, we understand as a government what our obligations are with respect to anyone who's rendered by this government to another country. That is that we seek to satisfy ourselves they will not be tortured, he said. And we do that in every case. And if, in fact, he had been rendered to Syria, we would have sought those same kind of assurances as we do in every case. Maher Arar.
Well, my question to him is very simple. I think his answer really is he's underestimating how smart the American people are. You know, we've seen over the past couple of years other cases where individuals have been rendered to other countries for the sole purpose of extracting information. And this information extracted under torture ended up in the hands of American authorities. So for him to say that we do not send, that we get assurances from people, well, you know, how do you believe, let's take this as a fact. We don't really know whether they actually sought assurances, but let's assume they did get assurances from the Syrians. Why would they believe the Syrians, given that the State Department on a yearly basis criticizes the human rights records in Syria? In fact, just a couple of days, if I remember correctly, after I went public about my story in November of 2003, President Bush himself clearly spoke critically of Syria, and he, if I remember the expression he used, he said Syria left its people with legacy of torture. So how could, you know, I'll just give a simple analogy here, and I think this will explain my point. Let's say I tell you there is a serial rapist or serial killer in this room, and I would like one of your relatives or your son or daughter to stay alone with him, you know, for long periods of time. Would you really, you know, if this person tells you, no, don't worry, I'm not going to harm your brother or sister, would you really trust what he's saying to you, given his past history, given the fact he raped many women, given the fact that he killed innocent people before? Well, clearly everyone knows that Syria has practiced torture for many years. And for them to say, well, we sought assurances, I don't think it's an acceptable answer. The American government and those people who are responsible for what they did to me, they should be held accountable in a court of law.
Let's go to what President Bush said about Syria, actually yesterday at the United Nations.
To the people of Syria, your land is home to a great people with a proud tradition of learning and commerce. Today, your rulers have allowed your country to become a crossroad for terrorism. In your midst, Hamas and Hezbollah are working to destabilize the region, and your government is turning your country into a tool of Iran. This is increasing your country's isolation from the world. Your government must choose a better way forward by ending its support for terror and living in peace with your neighbors and opening the way to a better life for you and your families.
Maher Arar, your response to President Bush calling Syria the place the U.S. deported you to, a crossroads for terrorism.
Well, this is exactly the point. You know, on one hand, President Bush is criticizing Syria for supporting terrorism, and he criticized them of their human rights records. But on the other hand, his government is willing to send people like me to countries like Syria to be tortured. Well, I think there's clearly a double standard here, and I think what we've just heard seconds ago is only for, in my opinion, for public consumption. And I think the American people, in light of what we've learned in the past couple of years, I think are asking now healthy questions, and I don't think they really believe what they hear anymore.
I wanted to ask you about some of the findings in this report that were pretty remarkable. You had Ward Elcock, the former head of Canadian Intelligence Spy Agency, testifying that sometimes Canada's spy agency uses information obtained through torture. When asked if the spy agency would use evidence obtained under torture from organizations with which Canada has relationships, he said yes. Franco Pillarella, Canada's former ambassador to Syria, stunned the inquiry and the diplomatic world when he denied knowledge of Syria's use of torture. Evidence showed that Pillarella appeared more eager to transmit Arar's false confessions to Canada than to secure his release. And I'm reading from a CBC report, Canadian Broadcasting. Maher Arar.
You're right, Amy. I mean, speaking of the fact that the American authorities did the actual, what I would call the dirty work, this is not to say the Canadian government officials are not to blame. And you're right. There have been many interesting findings. One of those is the fact that the Canadian ambassador here brought the false confession back to Canada. And what is really troubling is they never questioned the reliability of the information, and in many other incidents, they actually said things to the opposite. One instance, for example, the RCMP described this as information obtained voluntarily, by the Syrians. So this is really troubling for Canadian officials to give reliability to such statements, and we really have to revisit the issue of what do we do with information obtained from those countries with poor human rights records, and whether in the first place we should be asking for this information.
Maher, what did they do to you in Syria? How did they get you to say that you went to Afghanistan?
Well, basically, the Syrians, the first day, they threatened me to use what we call now, we know now is the German chair. They did not physically abuse me the first day, but that was a clear message that if I do not respond quickly, or in their opinion, I do not tell them the truth, they'll use other means. In fact, the second day they started beating me with a cable, and the pain was so extreme to the point where I would just say anything just to stop the torture. And the most extreme day was the third day, where they, to my surprise, they wanted me to confess that I have been to Afghanistan. And at the end of that day, I couldn't take it anymore, and I told them what they wanted to hear. Well, the torture did not stop completely, but it decreased in intensity after, So, but I can tell you definitely, Amy, that, in 2 weeks from that, or in a week time from that day, I could tell in their eyes that, I had nothing. Well, they did not say this to me directly, but, I could feel that the Syrians were just doing the work for the Americans and possibly the Canadian government.
How could you feel that?
Well, it's in their eyes, you know. Had the Canadian government put the pressure in the first place to get me released, I think this would have happened early on. I can't confirm 100% that this is what, but I could feel in their eyes that, you know, they were laughing, they were smiling. I really was not of interest to them. In fact, later on in one of the meetings with the Canadian MPs, the Syrians clearly said we did not ask for Arar, and we had no interest in him.
The Alberto Gonzalez says this wasn't a rendition, just a deportation. Did they explain why they deported you to Syria when, in fact, you're a Canadian citizen and on your way home to Canada, just transiting through Kennedy Airport, switching planes?
Well, I've clearly stated to them that I wanted to go back to Canada. This is my home. This is where I had lived for the past 16 or 17 years. In fact, there was a document that, I filled out, and they asked me, where do you want to go? I said, to Canada. And they said, do you have any concerns going to Canada? I said, not at all. But during the six-hour exhaustive interview they conducted 2 days before they sent me to Syria, they asked me questions about why I didn't want to go to Syria. I gave them all kinds of reasons. One of them is my military service. I remember vividly telling them that, if you send me to Syria, I'll be tortured. But they did not seem to care, you know. And I don't think, you know, I think they're not being truthful when they compare my case to the standard deportation cases. First of all, I was not afforded due process like anyone else. I've asked many times to see a judge. I've asked many times to have full access to my lawyer. I when they decided to send me to Syria, they bundled me on a private jet, and I think this is very clear. It bears strong resemblance to the rendition practice by the CIA.
Maher, my last question is: when we last talked to you, you said your captors had destroyed your life. How are your spirits today?
Well, I'm a lot better today than I was 3 years ago after my return to Canada, even though there was a campaign of misinformation conducted by some Canadian officials to intentionally damage my reputation. But the support I have received from the Canadian public and from the some American public, you know, helped me all along. And if it was not for that support, I wouldn't have been able to sustain all this pressure and stress. I can definitely tell you that I'm delighted with the recommendations of the report, and I do hope that the Canadian government will act on these recommendations. And also I would like our Prime Minister Harper, when he visits the U.S. tomorrow, to raise this issue with his counterpart and basically complain about the treatment I received.
Maher Arar, I want to thank you very much for being with us, joining us from Canada, vindicated by a Canadian inquiry. That does it for our broadcast tonight. I'll be in Chicago at Leveron Hall at Northwestern University, the Evanston campus. Tomorrow I'll be in Ann Arbor, Michigan Theater on Friday in Detroit. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Rupa Gokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuva Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Youth. Special thanks to David Goodman, to Chuck Skourich, to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org, for tour details. Thanks for joining us.